This is Omaha Sports Insider with Joe Quinn and Nick Handley. Follow the show on Twitter at AM590 ESPN Radio. Now, here's Joe and Nick.
Fernando got away with a push-off, and there's the flop by Borchard. I mean, you know, I don't know that it was a flop, but he did exactly what you were talking about, Jake. Coach Miles onto the floor.
That's the same thing that's called all the time in college basketball.
Yeah.
And then I think what Coach Miles is really upset about
down here
is Fernando almost steps over Tanner Borchardt. That's taunting. That gets called all the time in college basketball. If you've been watching any game, any league, if a player says something or taunts, that's an easy tee.
So you remember the tee that Isaac Copeland got at Purdue last year for just looking over his shoulder at the guy he dunked on.
Or the one at Minnesota when he just flips the ball and gets the tee there. I mean, come on.
Well, there is the description on the radio call with Kent Pifelka, Jake Muehlheisen, of a controversial moment in the game last night, Nick, where Bruno Fernando is basically backing down Tanner Borchardt.
Yep.
Perhaps has a little bit of a shove on him. Borchardt goes to the deck. Fernando goes up and dunks the ball. What really got people upset, and what ultimately got Tim Miles the technical, is as he comes down, he either steps on Borchardt.
Yeah, I mean, that happens, whether it's intentional or not.
He either steps on him, he stomps on him, or he steps over him. Yeah. And I think the reason Miles was so infuriated is it's a reviewable play.
Sure.
They can go to the monitor, they can look at it and see if there's anything there. Now, in terms of the initial play, before we get to the stomping, the stepping, the whatever, I don't know that there's enough there for an offensive foul on Bruno Fernando. I don't know that you call the flop on Tanner Borchardt either.
Nope, and they didn't do that.
I think KP probably had it right. I think Borchardt probably went to the ground a little too easy.
He did.
I think Fernando probably did touch him a little bit, but probably not enough to warrant a foul call. And so really the controversy here is in, should they have gone to the monitor and called anything else?
Mm-hmm.
Watching it in real time, I didn't see a whole lot. Watching it in slow-mo, you know, in the replays, first of all, before we even get to that, let me just say, at this point in the game's over anyway.
Yeah, right? 38-30, it made it a 10-point game. Well, 12 minutes left to go. It was 38-30. The dunk made it 40-30.
The way Nebraska was playing, I'm not confident this play made the difference. Now, you could make the case that if there was enough there to eject Bruno Fernando from the game, you know, run him, then maybe it changes what Maryland is doing. Nick, I didn't see any of that. I didn't see it as a flagrant two type thing where he is trying to hurt him or he intentionally goes out of his way to stomp on him. Did he step on him?
Yes, he does.
Yeah, a little bit.
That happens.
Sure.
He does step on him. He just can't prove, was it malicious? Was it intentional?
Did he stomp on him?
No, he stepped on him.
I don't think so. Did he step over him?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, but I mean, at the same time, was there malicious intent there, or was he just literally coming down from dunking the ball and Borchardt was kind of on the floor underneath him? I don't know. I think at worst for Maryland, they call a technical foul on Bruno Fernando. Nebraska gets a couple of free throws out of the deal. Does it alter the outcome of the game? In my opinion, no, it absolutely does not. Did Miles do the right thing by getting up and exploding and getting a technical and defending his player? Yeah, I think he probably did. I mean, he's trying to stand up for his guy. He's trying to defend him, do anything he can.
Just trying to push buttons.
I really, ultimately, then Andy Katz, you heard Jacob talk about that. Andy Katz on the Big Ten Network postgame show actually called out the Nebraska local media, which I thought was kind of funny. He's like, well, you should have asked for a pool reporter to ask the referees a question. It's like, well, okay, that may be true. But you look at that and you see something hugely controversial. Everybody in the arena saw it full speed, maybe didn't see it quite that way. I don't know. I didn't really have any issue with the way things were handled, and I don't think it really makes an overall difference in the outcome of the game.
Yeah, the Andy Katz thing is like, lighten up, Francis. I mean, don't sit there and put the local media that was on site on blast because they did not get a pool reporter to have the officials available. You know, lighten up, Francis, okay? This is the frustration of Tim Miles. This is what probably should have taken place. Is since it is a reviewable play, it should have been at least reviewed. Now, I don't think, and here's the other thing that I'm not 100% certain on. Even if they deemed that he stepped over Tanner Borchardt in a taunting manner, if it's not initially called, The only thing that they can review is, I think, the contact of, okay, did he step on him? Just like when you're trying to find if someone had an elbow, if an elbow, you know, caught a guy, if it was either flagrant one or flagrant two. So at the very least, I do think this thing should have been reviewed. I don't think you're going to see Bruno Fernando get ejected in the game.
No.
And I don't think the officials can say, oh, yeah, he did taunt him, so now we can tee him up. I don't think they can do that because Jake Muehlheisen is absolutely right. How many times have you seen somebody do that in a college game and get teed? Probably 9 out of 10 times. So the fact that it wasn't teed up when he sort of stepped over him, and if you go by Bruno Fernando's body language, because it was a huge dunk. I mean, and the officials had it right till the very end where they didn't review it. That's where I think they maybe dropped the ball a little bit. But they had it right by not calling an offensive foul. And what Tanner Borkar was doing is what you see bigs do defensively all the time. Once they take that initial sort of body check, then they know, okay, this is how he's trying to back me down. So mm-hmm. when he leans into me again, I'm going to fall. Tanner Borkar definitely flopped. Okay, so the correct call actually took place, and that was no call. Where I think the officials messed up twice. One, I think you tech Fernando for taunting.
Sure.
Okay, I think you do that because you see it happen so many times. I think he clearly was trying to show up Tanner Borkart. I mean, just based on the body language. As he steps over, if he wasn't kind of, you know, bobbing his head, you know, sort of jawing a little bit, then maybe you say, okay, he's just trying to step over him and get away from him. The body language, if I'm officiating that, leads me to believe that, okay, that's enough. There's taunting there. I'm going to go ahead and tee him up because we've seen things that were even less egregious get teed up.
Sure.
So I do agree with that. And then the other thing is, and I think what Tim Miles was also frustrated with, is since it was reviewable, why did they not review it? Because there was a foot that comes down on Tanner Borkart. At the very least, review it, slow it down, and then determine, which I think wasn't intentional. I don't think the stomp was intentional, and I think the officials just going to the monitor, slowing it down, and being able to say, yeah, you know, there's nothing there for us to really, you know, throw a flagrant two or anything that would warrant an ejection. I think you at least do the game a service, and especially to Miles in Nebraska and the fans there, by saying, all right, we're going to look at it just to make sure we're correct on what we initially thought.
I honestly think, Nick, even if they go to the monitor, which I agree with you, I think they probably should have in this instance, I'm not even sure when they look at it that they're going to call a technical on Bruno Fernando.
I think it's somewhat of a gray area. I just don't think you can.
Yeah, but, even if they do, okay, so what? It's two free throws for Nebraska. The way they were shooting free throws last night, there's a chance they missed both of the free throws anyway. It didn't impact the outcome of the game at the end of the day. So is it a moment in the game where things could have perhaps gone a little bit back the other direction? Perhaps, Nick, but Nebraska was playing so terrible by that point. I mean, they just had nothing going. I don't know that all of a sudden helps them recover and bounce back.
But that's my question, though. Okay, so if they do go to the monitor and they realize, okay, the contact with the foot to Borkart it's inadvertent, so there's no call there. They can't look at that and say, oh, he did taunt him, though.
I don't think they can do that. I'm not sure what they can and can't call.
I think it's purely on the contact, right?
I would assume so, because they can go and call a flagrant one or flagrant two right off the monitor. And you see him stop it all the time for that, to see if a guy is throwing an elbow
right,
or something like that.
I don't think they can, if it's something that's not based on contact, just body language, where the stomp over, because I do think the step over, That probably warrants a technical, but if you go back and review it, I don't think that's something that they can actually say, oh, well, the stomp wasn't intentional, but he did taunt, so we can slap him with a T. I don't think you can do that. Well, I might be wrong, though.
And, you know, in the moment, too, again, on the same BTN postgame show where Andy Katz made his proclamation against the Nebraska media, Robbie Hummel, who, of course, played at Purdue, you know, he made the comment, well, that wasn't a natural fall down. Yeah. You know, there was something going on. There was something more. It's like, yeah. If you look at it 10 times in slow motion, I think you can talk yourself into that. But boy, if you watch it real time, I can't say definitively that he tried to stomp him out. I don't know.
I think there was a step over taunt, and that was it. Now, maybe if you ask Bruno Fernando today, he'd say, yeah, I did do that. But I'm sure he's not going to say that. But
I can pull out a Aqib Talib here.
Right. I don't even if you slow that thing down and you initially think that now is inadvertent, I don't think the monitor and slowing it down is going to be able to convince you that it was intentional.
This is Lee in Lincoln. Hello, Lee.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple of things I want to let's see, how do I want to say this? I want to split apart two different things.
Okay.
I think that, so one is the state of Nebraska basketball at this point. I'm kind of putting it on the coaches. They've got to do something, and I know the players are the ones who shoot the ball. They've got to set up some sets, not the motion offense where they look for their little thing. They've got to do some isolation things like they do in the NBA, play a two-man game, and get either, well, Roby or Watson or Palmer so that they can play a pick-and-roll or pick-and-pop, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Miles has to do something to keep them from those nine-minute
scoring droughts.
You know, scoring droughts. Mm-hmm. Thanks, I appreciate your help. That's the only thing. But man, that is a killer. We were ahead 15-8,
yeah.
7 or 8 coming out, whatever it was. Okay, now, and you guys have already talked about that, and I appreciate that. Okay, the second thing, you guys and I were watching. Not the same game, man. What's the guy's
Bruno Fernando?
Yeah,
Bruno Fernando.
Fernando.
Uh huh.
Okay, that was clearly an offensive foul. He moved him. He moved Borchardt out of his spot. That was a forearm shiver, guys. Mm.
Okay, so now hold on, Lee. Hold on. Okay,
an offensive foul. And the ball goes the other way. I'm not talking about where it came down. If
okay.
Yeah. Or it didn't. That's a separate issue.
You're talking about where Borchardt fell. Okay.
Well, he fell because he got hammered by a guy who weighed 280 pounds. I mean, I watched it over. I have to be filming the game. I mean, I recorded the game so I can watch some of it over again. My wife likes watching. She was gone, so she could watch some of it. I don't know, man. Are you really? It was an offensive foul.
I don't know. I felt like Borchardt got that first sort of body check, and so he had made up his mind, okay, he's going to do it again to back me down, and I'm going down, and I'm going to sell the foul. And to Borchardt's credit, a lot of times the official will give you that foul. So I'm not saying it's a smart defensive play because you will get that call quite a bit. I didn't see any kind of extension from Bruno Fernando to make me believe that he put a forearm shiver.
Lee, let me ask you this, Lee. I think he got hit harder the first time when he didn't go down than when he actually went to the deck. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that's what I'm saying.
So you're saying the first one.
So when he gets bumped the first time.
Okay. I can get on board with that.
All right.
Yeah.
Appreciate the call, Lee. Yeah. I think they should have maybe called the offensive foul when Fernando bumps him the first time to back him down. But
that's where you see more of the arm come out than when Borchardt actually flops down.
The problem is that, and this is just the way college basketball is that if the defender doesn't go down or significantly, if he gives way, if he gives space, you're probably not going to get that call very
often. If Borchardt flops on the first one,
he gets the call.
He's getting the call.
Because I agree.
There's definitely movement with the arm of Bruno Fernando. I'm watching it right now. And yeah, there is much more. Okay, I'm watching it right as we talk. Yes, he puts a shoulder into him on the first one. And
if he goes to the deck on the first one, he gets the offensive foul.
Where Borchardt goes down, I feel like he leans more than he actually shoves when Borchardt actually goes down.
Yeah.
That's how I'm seeing it. But I only have one angle.
The La Liga guys.
I'm only looking at one angle.
The La Liga guys would be proud.
You know what? If I have the player's bench angle, so where I'm not seeing the back of their jerseys, but I'm seeing the front, I could make that call. Much better. But the angle I have, that's all I can go
the
off.
The one available angle.
That's all I can go off.
All right. Hey, TJ has the headlines next. It has actually been a wild day around the sports world. It was the NBA trade deadline.
Oh,
and
TJ's
I feel like,
geeked out, too.
Dude, I feel like half the league got traded today at the last minute. Like, everybody except Anthony Davis, I think, got traded
today.
There's
some names, but... Yeah.
And much as it moved the news. A lot of former college basketball stars on the movie. Like, oh, I forgot that guy's still playing in the league.
Got that NBA trade line, the trade deadline adrenaline rush going on.
There you go. That's next. AM 590.
ESPN Mall. Going to be talking some Hawkeye basketball, Hawkeye football, too, with the final national signing day taking place yesterday. Scott Docterman from The Athletic going to be joining us in just about 10 minutes. Also going to be talking to Mitch Sherman, some college hoops and college football news, and also Darren Hansen. UNO basketball, they're on the road tonight in Sioux Falls taking on South Dakota. That's coming up in the 5 o'clock hour. We've got headlines. TJ's got NBA headlines. What's up?
Yeah, so too many trades to count.
Have you caught your breath?
A little bit. Let's just go with the big ones here. So the 76ers sent ex-top pick Fultz to the Magic. The Grizzlies send Gasol to the Raptors while keeping Mike Conley. And the Bucks acquire Nikola Mirotic in a three-player deal, guys.
Just trying to wrap my head around the ones that seem to be the most impactful.
Well, I can tell
Gasol, would that be number one? I would think.
Yeah, maybe. The Mirotic deal to the Bucks probably, I think, has a chance to be bigger. Actually, the biggest one, remind me of the deal that the 76ers and Clippers made yesterday, TJ, because that's probably the biggest one out of all of this.
Yeah, Tobias Harris, Boban Marjanovic.
You guys don't want to go with Fultz, huh?
I think the Magic are not probably going to be a huge factor in the East this year.
Is Markel Fultz ever going to be able to find his shot again?
High risk, high reward. I think that's the best way to put it, like TJ just did. Low risk, high reward.
Yeah.
I would say that the biggest takeaway from the trade deadline on the whole in the NBA is, first of all, this is like the Major League Baseball or NFL trade deadline that we all dream of, where there's like literally 50 deals in the last hour. I mean, that's how it went today. It was crazy. Like Adrian Wojnarowski, that dude's thumbs might need to be amputated with all of the typing that he
was
doing.
Dropping bombs.
He was all over the place. The top four teams in the East got a lot better. The teams in the West, Rockets didn't do much. Lakers have made some piddly little moves. The Nuggets didn't do anything that I can recall. Of course, the Warriors are set. So really, you've got like Golden State that everybody's chasing. But in reality, the teams that got better at the trade deadline are like the Sixers, the Bucks. I think you make a heck of a case. The Celtics didn't really do anything. The Raptors making some moves today. What was the move the Raptors made? Memphis
Gasol.
Guy. Yeah, Marc Gasol. Thank you. I was going to say, I know we just talked about it. The Raptors making moves. So really, the top teams of the East are the ones that made all the noise. And then
the
Golden
Lakers
State.
Got Muscala. They got Mike Muscala.
The Lakers
gave up Michael Beasley.
They did.
As well.
They did.
So Beasley was part of a trade that did not involve one Anthony Davis. Sad.
Unfortunately.
And as of now, Lonzo Ball,
still a Laker.
He's still in L.A., so that's good.
Funniest thing I saw today is the show on Fox Sports 1 with Skip, Shannon Sharp, Undisputed.
Undisputed.
LeVar Ball was a guest today, so there you go. Put those three guys in a room together. Shannon Sharp, Skip Bayless, and LeVar Ball.
Who's
going to
be the most rational thinker?
So LeVar is waxing poetic about how, you know, again, it's all Luke Walton's fault that the Lakers aren't any good and that Lonzo is struggling. Probably Luke Walton's fault that Lonzo got hurt at one point. I mean, it's all Luke Walton's fault at this point. And, you know, he was, again, waxing about how it would be a huge mistake for the Lakers to consider trading Lonzo. And he even went so far as to say that if they trade Lonzo, they will never win, you know, won't win any championships. They'll never win a championship again if Lonzo Ball gets traded from the Lakers. And then the voice of reason
that makes sense
in all of this, Skip Bayless. I mean, that tells you something right there. Steps in and actually says, so you mean to tell me that even though they have LeBron James, if they trade Lonzo Ball, the Lakers aren't winning another championship?
Oh, yeah. We all know the straw that stirs the drink in L.A. It ain't LBJ.
Bron.
It ain't LBJ.
Guy. Bron.
Kuzma, who dat? Lonzo, man.
Oh,
some NFL news. Kyler Murray on the list of players for the scouting combine for the NFL. And Chiefs GM tells Patrick Mahomes to stop playing pickup basketball.
Yeah, he had like the sweet little like crossover and little scoop shot, and
he looked good.
I saw a lot of my friends that are Chiefs fans kind of freaking out over that, like, please don't blow out a knee. But you know, boys will be boys, but you got to understand what is riding on your health now too. So I can understand why the Chiefs would say, Pat, no, please do not be doing that. And yeah, for Kyler Murray, I think this was kind of expected. I think in order to fully understand the value that you bring to each sport, you've got to go through that evaluation process. And the combine, I think, is going to give him a lot of good insight. He's going to get a lot of ideas. Having a chance to sit down and talk to GMs and coaches, I mean, that's a big part of this process. I think that this is a big decision for Kyler Murray still that he has to make. And I think that this is a big part of it. So I don't look at this and say, well, that there you go. Kyler Murray is definitely playing football. I think that the chances are better that he plays football than he does baseball at this point. But I don't think just the fact that he is going to be part of the combine all of a sudden makes that so. I think this is just part of that process and that evaluation process to find out exactly and allow him to kind of come to that conclusion of what he wants to do.
The XFL has its first coach, guys. It's going to be Bob Stoops will be the coach and the GM for the Dallas team.
Is he playing too?
I don't know, man. I'm really surprised to see this. I mean,
I am too, because I thought he would resurface either in the NFL at some level or in college football.
Or be a broadcaster or something. I
could see him coaching college football.
Well, and maybe it's just the stress level here is going to be really, really low because, you know, the XFL, I'm assuming, will administer a lot of the day-to-day stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, he just is out there coaching, calling plays, X's and O's. So doesn't have to recruit, doesn't have to spend, you know, hours and weeks and months away from his family. I don't know, but just to see a name that big kind of resurface with something like this. I was quite frankly very surprised to see that earlier today.
I'll say this for the XFL. It brings a little bit of credibility to
sure,
it because
no
this,
doubt.
Is, this is a Bob Stoops who was also rumored to some NFL jobs during mm-hmm. his career at Oklahoma. So, I mean, it's kind of, you know, similar impact that, you know, if you got a guy like Urban Meyer, you know, a guy that was also being rumored to NFL jobs when he was at the peak of his career. So you get a guy like Bob Stoops. And that's the one thing that I continue to watch and sort of monitor with the XFL is the level of credibility that it had the first time around and what it will have this time around. When you can get names like that in, you can get that initial impact. And so we'll be curious to see if you get other very familiar, highly regarded names as coaches or general managers being involved, because I think there are some good people in place. If you can continue to do that, I think all of a sudden you do get a little bit more of an immediate impact than I'd originally anticipated.
You know, the one thing, too, that I'm interested to see with the XFL is they have said they're not going to be beholden to the NFL's rule of not letting guys play after one year of college football.
Yeah.
So that's not going to be a huge number of guys, Nick, but it could give some more credibility to where you do have elite players who just maybe aren't ready for that NFL level yet that they could grab onto and make a part of their game. Mm-hmm. So we'll see.
Hall of Famer Frank Robinson passes away at 83 today, guys.
Yeah.
First African-American manager in Major League Baseball and obviously one of the all-time greats.
Yeah. I mean,
well, what do you say?
Exactly. I mean, it's sad anytime we lose a legend. And Frank Robinson was clearly that. And, you know, just that breakthrough alone, you know, being a manager and for my Cleveland Indians, too. I mean, it's just kind of cool as a player manager to see that. You know, it's something that I think when we look back at a lot of the barriers that were broken when it did come to seeing, you know, African-American athletes in the sport of baseball and sort of watching the trends shift a little bit. I mean, yes, you would still love to see more as a part of the game, too. But, I mean, that was a significant moment. I mean, we always talk about Jackie Robinson and the barrier that he broke. But, I mean, you think of a guy like Frank Robinson just from a managerial point of it, I think that was extremely significant too. So yeah, definitely a sad day. Lost a legend.
And sticking with the passing away death theme here, we have Sybil Marie Hicks, who recently passed away, and she wrote her own obituary.
Oh, these are always good.
Some highlights include: I leave behind my loving husband Ron Hicks, whom I affectionately refer to as, and I'm pretty sure I can say this, but I have the dump button ready, Joe, a horse's ass.
Oh, yeah, you're good.
Oh, yeah, you're good on fine. That one.
I also left behind my children, whom I tolerated over the years. And I finally had the smoking hot body I always wanted, having been cremated.
Ooh! This lady's got some sass.
She
does. Wow.
You know what? That's when you always hear people say, I mean, if you've ever been to a funeral and you've lost a loved one and you always say, they wouldn't want us to cry. They'd want us to, you know, laugh and celebrate their honor. I think of humor like that, and it makes it a little bit easier to do that when you hear the person themselves saying that. You almost feel bad for, like, crying or mourning their loss over, you know, over and over because, you hear things like, ah, this is great. That's
nothing,
fantastic.
You know, that's funny. Nothing will ever top the one we talked about. What was it, about 6 months ago maybe, where the ladies – kids wrote the obituary, and they had been estranged from this lady a long time. And the closing line was, she has died and will now await judgment.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, man. Because she left her kids for, like, what, her brother?
Yeah, something really.
It was like her husband's brother, I think, she ran off with, and the kids were like, she's dead, and now she awaits judgment. It's like, oh my God.
Well, do you guys remember?
Who says that about their mother?
This was one of the funniest things. It happened, gosh, it was back when Cutler was still a quarterback for the Bears. I want to say like maybe 2016, like his final year. A lady said, her name was Elizabeth Bowman. Said died peacefully January 9th, 2016, surrounded by her children. Betsy was an elementary school teacher and later a tutor, but her passion and focus was being a dedicated and involved mother and grandmother. She was a woman of loyalty, integrity, opinion, curiosity, intelligence, a lifelong fan of the Cubs, Blackhawks, and Bears, except Jay Cutler. That was actually in the obit.
That's funny.
Except Jay Cutler. Like, I mean, as an athlete, like, what do you think? If you're Jay Cutler, I mean, we know how Jay Cutler probably feels about it. He's like, I don't really care. But, like, just think if you're, like, some athlete, pro athlete, and all of a sudden you're mentioned in the obit as fan of this team, except for you. Like, that's got to sting a little bit, I would think. And it seems like, by all accounts, she was a very, you know, great lady. She just didn't like Jay Cutler.
All right. Those are the headlines from around the sports world and beyond. Up next, talk some Hawkeye hoops and National Signing Day for the Iowa Hawkeyes with Scott Docterman of The Athletic next on AM 590.
ESPN. Talk some Hawkeye athletics with recruiting wrapping up yesterday for National Signing Day, and also, of course, some Hawkeye hoops. Scott Docterman of The Athletic joining us here. And Scott, before we get into basketball, just some final thoughts on the recruiting class for Iowa football. I know everybody sometimes kind of dwells too much on the number, but it seems like a pretty consistent, you know, recruiting feel for Iowa, where if you're looking at the numbers, you may not be overwhelmed, but it's not what these guys do. It's how they develop them. What did you see, or anything stand out from this particular class?
You know, I don't think anything stands out right now today other than grabbing a graduate transfer. Mm-hmm. And I know Iowa tends to get that at punter. And I think I know Iowa gets a little bit maligned. You know, punting is winning and all of that stuff. But last year they were, what, 83rd in the country in punting?
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, just dreadful. And really it cost them, I thought, in a couple of games. So, I mean, going from 83rd to grabbing a guy who was – 16th in the country, I think was really important for Iowa. Other than that, you know, they have 6 early enrollees, which is by far the most Iowa's ever had. And they expect a few of them to be able to come in and contribute, possibly play, as reserves right away. So I think overall it was a nice class for Iowa. Didn't have kind of that record breaker or that guy that's a signature player yet. But they had a few nice additions, I thought.
Would you say, recruiting included in this, Scott, that Kirk Ferentz has obviously been around for a long time, and we like to think of him as kind of this old school guy, but would you say over the last couple of years you have noticed that both he and the rest of the Iowa staff are starting to embrace some of these new things in college football a little bit more? You know, like you mentioned, the early enrollees, and I've seen some of his assistants be maybe more active on social media than what, people realize or would expect. Have you noticed that maybe they're kind of starting to pick up some of this new stuff more as well?
I think a lot of that has to do with Brian Ferentz being his offensive coordinator, because Brian's a little bit more in tune to what is the pulse of the country, I guess, at that level. And Kirk is willing to adapt. He's not so old school that he wants to, keep things, where he's just simply writing letters out on letterhead or whatever. But, he does some of that as well. But, I think there's a willingness to go deeper into social media, to do what, graduate transfers, the transfer portal. That's not where Kirk Ferentz wants to live, and that's probably not the best place for a school like Iowa, where you just can't throw guys on the field and have them perform in their system because it's so technically difficult. But that said, they're willing to take chances where most people don't see it. And again, you look at, each of the last 3 years, they've pulled out a guy, in the summer or, that's a grad transfer that's really had a big impact on this team. A couple of years ago it was running back James Butler from Nevada. Last year was Mekhi Sargent, who was a late addition in the summer. And before that, it was a graduate transfer. And they're still looking. I think they really think they need at least one more, maybe defensive lineman, a grad transfer type. I know they're looking at a couple pretty closely. So I think overall, that's some of the differences than, you know, maybe what the stereotype was, certainly 5 years ago, which I think just about everybody could agree was a little bit too conservative for the program.
Well, Scott, for Iowa, they get a much-needed break after a huge win on Friday against the Michigan Wolverines, and now you look at a tricky road challenge. I wouldn't say it's a tall task, but a tricky road challenge tonight against Indiana. Just watching that game sort of unfold against Michigan last Friday, what stood out, and what do you feel like this could do for Iowa trying to kind of get back in the thick of things when it comes to the Big Ten, you know, the upper tier right now?
You know, I think with Michigan, I mean, this is one of those situations, and it happens all over the place in the Big Ten, where, you know, some styles just work better against other styles. And Iowa traditionally has played really well against Michigan. I think at one point, going into maybe a year and a half ago, they'd won five straight. You know, Michigan is such a precise defensive and offensive team that if Iowa can attack it, it really throws them off and they can't really keep up. I mean, it was kind of the opposite that way with Wisconsin and Indiana, where Wisconsin won, I think, 10 in a row at one point just because of that same type of scenario. So, you know, Iowa was able to, you know, they've improved a lot in their three-point defense, which has really kept, you know, which kept Michigan on its heels. It only shot 24%. And then after that, you had, you know, Iowa was able to really take advantage of some of the, you know, some fast break opportunities. They out-rebounded the Wolverines by 12. So there was a lot there that Iowa was able to take advantage of, and the Wolverines their worst defeat of the year. So, mm-hmm. you know, going into Indiana, this is a scary game for Iowa. It's a winnable game. It's a tough environment. We all know that. But what Iowa has struggled against Indiana in the past about is when Iowa decides it wants to just completely play up and down the court, Indiana has better athletes. So Indiana beats it at that same level of play. You know, simply because if they kind of play street ball, you know, you're playing them against the wrong team for that. Now, if Iowa can be aggressive and yet be precise and disciplined, I think they got a good chance of winning even on the road. You know, it's just going to be a matter of, you know, not quick shooting the ball, not being, you know, make bad errors and mistakes, you know, Tyler Cook being a little more under control near the basket. And I think they've got a chance at winning this game. Then they play Northwestern and Rutgers, so they have an opportunity to go on a nice little run here, but tonight's going to be a challenging game for them.
You know, Scott, when you look at this roster, you know, Tyler Cook, obviously probably their best player, Wieskamp, their best defender, and certainly looks like the future of this team. But since they've gotten Luka Garza back from injury, could you make a case that he's sort of become the embodiment of what this team really wants to be all about?
He's the most valuable player. I think he is the heart and soul of this team. As you mentioned, I agree with you. Tyler Cook right now today is their best player. Joe Wieskamp eventually will be one of the best players they've probably ever had because he's so good in so many different facets, and he's just a freshman. But Luka Garza is just tough, hard-nosed, works hard, gets baskets, you know, is more athletic than he looks, you know, and can do it in different ways. You know, he's not just a post player. He can shoot from the outside. He's tough on the board. And then you throw on Ryan Kreener, you know, who's a junior, and, you know, he's done a really nice job of complimenting of Garza because he's a little bit more of that tough guy enforcer post player who can also go outside. So they've got enough players in the post that really make him not only dangerous, but, you know, they're pretty athletic and do a nice job of kind of manning that position.
Well, and Scott, the defensive performance against Michigan was great. I know that's something that has kind of hampered Iowa throughout the year. Just looking at this matchup tonight, do you feel like this is another opportunity for Iowa to kind of improve on those defensive numbers, much like we saw Friday?
It is, and I think what Iowa has to do is just continue to become better at the zone. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably the defense that works best for it because it just doesn't have the defensive players to stop the ball at the point of attack. I mean, Jordan Bohannon does a nice job of getting players involved. He's a good three-point shooter. Connor McCaffrey, when he gets in, can kind of move the ball and doesn't really hunt his shot, but, you know, runs the offense in a decent fashion. But they don't have that on-ball defender that can really do, you know, that can create problems for people. So I think when they're in a zone, I think they've been much better. And again, their three-point defense has kept them from being, you know, abused that way. So I really think that that's the smartest case for them is to just be patient, be tough, be disciplined, force them to take a shot. Because if you start getting in a relay race and in transition against Indiana, and you know, even though they're not very good, they've got enough athletes that they can beat Iowa.
Talking to Scott Docterman of The Athletic. Scott, I know that before the season started, a lot of conversation about, you know, what this team needed to accomplish this year. Certainly looks like they are on track to make the NCAA tournament. Is that kind of the way that you read it as well, with what they have left in front of them, that still is the goal and a very attainable one at that?
I think that's the goal for this year, and I think that would be an attainable one, and I think that would be a really good one. I mean, you're talking about a team that went 4-14 last year and was very disappointing. And I think, you know, the one difference maybe between, you know, Fran and a bad season and maybe Kirk in a bad season is, you know, Kirk has built up a lot of equity in Iowa just from his past and what he does kind of off the field. And Fran hasn't quite gotten there yet. So fans were really kind of edgy. And then he had, you know, that extension, which fans weren't real thrilled about either. And so, you know, going into this year, there were a lot of question marks, especially defensively. And there have been those questions throughout the year and the way they played, you know, even a week and a half ago when they lost to Minnesota or when they lost twice to Michigan State. But what we've seen is that they have made strides defensively. I mean, they're still among the worst teams when it comes to points allowed per game in the Big Ten. But they've cut like 4 to 5 points per game off and added about 3 forward. So, you know, you're basically saying that they're better on 4 to 5 possessions per game than they were last year, which is the difference between a lot of these wins and losses. And then ultimately, I think they get back to the tournament. Who knows? I'm not saying they're going to go to the Sweet 16 or the Final Four, but depending on matchups, they might win a game or two. And to me, that would be a very successful season in Iowa City.
Well, yeah, and Scott, with this next stretch of games where you do look at, okay, as we mentioned, Indiana, it's a winnable game, but then Northwestern at Rutgers, and then Maryland at home, is this kind of that opportunity? I mean, even Indiana at home, is this kind of that opportunity for Iowa to kind of settle in and maybe the best word to describe it, to be a little bit more trustworthy as far as one of the teams of the Big Ten that you understand, okay, this team is starting to take form, they've got winnable games, and it's when you win those games where you start kind of believing a little bit more in this team?
Yeah, and I think the fan base really needs that because it's been hard for them to buy in.
Right.
Because even in those good years a few years ago when they had like Roy Marble or Devin Marble and when they had, you know, Jared Utoff and those guys, they really weren't able to win a lot of those big games. And in critical junctures, they couldn't hit big shots. And they would go on a run, and then, you know, their two best years, they collapsed at the end. So, I mean, fans are just kind of antsy and anxious, I would say. And they want to believe, you know, they want to believe so badly. But yet when they do that over and over again, it's going to take some time for them to have that trust in the team that they're going to be able to be capable of doing it. So I think with the stretch of games that they've got coming up, you know, I mean, again, you know, in Indiana tonight, you know, Northwestern, Rutgers, as you mentioned, Maryland at home. They've only got two games against teams with winning Big Ten records, and that's Maryland at home and Wisconsin on the road, and I think they're both winnable. So, I mean, I'm not saying Iowa needs to win out or anything, but I think if they can, say, hold it down to 2 losses, get to the Big Ten tournament and actually do something, which they haven't done in, you know, 13 years, you know, I think they got a chance to have the fans really buy in and make this a memorable season.
Scott Docterman covering the Iowa Hawkeyes for The Athletic. Scott, really appreciate your time. Have a great rest of your week.
All right. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
You bet it, man. All right. Coming up in the 4 o'clock hour, we're going to talk to Mitch Sherman, ESPN.com. Also, Darren Hansen, UNO Hoops coach, is going to join us before we are out of here today, which, speaking of that, we are actually done at 5:45 today. Got Nebraska women's basketball coming to you tonight with Matt Coatney and Jeff Greisch on the call. That at 5:45 tonight here on AM 590.
ESPN tomorrow.
Friday on the Bottom Line starting at 10 a.m. on AM 590. We look ahead to the 2020-2021 classes with Mike Schaefer. Alliance of American Football reporter Ben Kirschival joins the show. Plus, Chris Heady, Nebraska reporter, and Movies with Micah. All starting at 10 a.m. on AM 590, ESPN Omaha.
Alliance of American Football reporter Ben Kirschival. Huh?
They got one of those?
Tomorrow. I guess so.
Yes, they have one.
The only thing I know about the Alliance of American Football, Nick, is Mike Riley's a coach.
Kenny Bell. Trell Newby.
Okay.
And Josh Banderas. I'm missing one.
Dang. Did you say Armstrong?
No. But no, these guys are on the same team. Is it for Salt Lake City? Oh, who is it? Okay. Kenny Bell, Banderas, Newby. There's a fourth. I'm totally blanking on this one. Former Husker, but they're on the same team.
Hmm.
I can't remember, but those three are there.
Nice. Yeah. Tanner Lee, perhaps? No. Or is he still bouncing around practice squads?
Oh, DeMarnay Pearsonell.
There's oh, okay. Yeah. There you go.
So DPE, Kenny Bell.
Okay, so maybe there will be a little local interest. Yeah, I mean, if you are football starved at this point.
Some flavor. So maybe that's what Michael's getting into.
Do we know, TJ, are they putting this stuff on TV anywhere? Is it going to be like ESPN Plus or anything?
I don't know. Let me see if I can find out here.
Yeah, my intrigue level is like zero, Nick, because I just don't.
Well, remember the UFL was trying to get on Spike?
Yeah, Spike TV.
Or I think it was on Spike.
Well, the XFL was on... God, was it Spike TV as well? The 1 year?
XFL, I thought, was on something different.
It wouldn't have been Spike TV at the time, probably.
Yeah,
but
it was on something different. What the heck was it on?
Hmm.
Yeah, I don't remember what it was on.
Like USA Network?
Yeah,
actually,
I think that might have been it. Well, I think it might have been USA.
They still do carry WWE on, I think it's on USA Network.
I think it might have been USA, if I remember correctly.
Looks like CBS and CBS Sports Network.
Okay. Wow. See, all
right.
Ooh, are they going to have Romo calling this stuff? Or what's the story there?
He'll be golfing, man.
That's right.
He's got to get ready for the Masters.
Well, he's got to. He actually tried to make the U.S. Open, a couple years ago and came up short.
Weren't they going to use him in golf coverage?
That was the discussion. Yeah.
It's like, what?
That was talked about.
Okay.
It was talked about.
Okay.
I don't know.
I get it. He's done well, but know your limits.
Not optimistic. Not optimistic.
I'd rather hear from an actual tour pro.
Would you like to hear from Sergio Garcia after what happened this past weekend?
Oh, yeah.
Sergio got DQ'd for destroying the greens, apparently.
And he was spending more time in the sand than David Hasselhoff.
He hits a shot from a sand trap. We retweeted this a couple days ago. He hits a shot out of the beach. And it's not a terrible shot. I mean, it's within probably 10 feet of the hole.
I'd love that shot.
And then smacks his club down in the bunker like three or four times, just swinging it like a wild man.
He was emotional, yeah.
I would say so. Fair assumption. AM 590.
ESPN.